And in the NHL, Chicago beat Minnesota 4-1. They are off tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. On this Monday, 18th of December, just 1 week away from Christmas Day. Should be a cloudy morning, a partly sunny afternoon, kind of mild today, a high heading 43. Some perspective on that number. Normal high this time of year is 32. The record high was 54 degrees, December 18th, 1877. Tonight, then, partly cloudy and windy, overnight low 36. And then tomorrow, Tuesday, look at this, sunny and breezy, tomorrow's high 45. So here are the current numbers. Wind is from the west-southwest at 6 miles per hour. 40 degrees in Kenosha, 38 this morning in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Donna Tourney, a licensed psychotherapist who has written a new book called Mindfulness for Emerging Adults, Finding Balance, Belonging, Focus, and Meaning in the Digital Age. We are talking, when we refer to emerging adults, as essentially young adults from their late teens through their 20s, perhaps into their early 30s, and talking about some of the challenges that are part of, in a sense, constructing a happy and meaningful and satisfying life. And this book takes into account some of the special challenges that confront this age group, these emerging adults, in this so-called digital age in which we live, in which there are certainly forces that can sometimes make construction of a happy, meaningful, satisfying life maybe a little more difficult than it once was. But as she points out in her book, this has always been a challenging time in life, and it's always been one of the most interesting points in a person's life and well worth studying. So this particular book is timely on a whole lot of different levels. It's published by Whole Person. Again, it's called Mindfulness for Emerging Adults. And Donna Tourney, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you. That was a great summary of the book. Thanks.
You bet. You bet. I wanted to also ask you, before we dig into the specifics of the book, you make mention at more than one point in the book about positive psychology. And you happen to be the second guest I've had within the last year on the program that either practices a positive psychology or makes very direct reference to it. Can you help us understand how you understand that term and how crucial it is to the work that you do and to the topic we're discussing today?
Sure, yes. Positive psychology has kind of grown in tandem with mindfulness. So they're both forms of psychology, if you will, that have been studied immensely over the past couple of decades. And positive psychology basically looks at what's going right with a person as opposed to what your diagnosis might be. So it's the practice of finding what your strengths are, finding what your values are, and living those out as opposed to focusing on what you may be lacking.
So tell us about this particular point in a person's life, this period we think of as emerging adulthood. I think one of the most interesting things you do early in the book is talk about some of the ways in which we used to think of this and the ways in which the benchmarks we used to think needed to be reached in order for people to achieve adulthood. How is that different now from what it once was?
Well, yeah, in the book I point out some of the benchmarks that sociologists used a couple of generations ago, which include getting married, having a child, owning a home, being financially independent, and those markers have changed so radically that we can't even really use them anymore to define adulthood. So what I'm proposing in the book is, well, since we kind of don't know what those physical markers are right now in these first decades of the digital age, let's look at what healthy adulthood is. So I propose saying emerging adults are moving towards established adulthood when they know how to ask for help, when they know how to build community, when they know how to regulate their emotions. And those things can be achieved through mindfulness.
And help our listeners understand the way in which you are using this term mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I'm using it as a tool to help emerging adults manage stress, basically. And if you look at the research that's been done over the last couple of decades on mindfulness, the definition they usually use is mindfulness is bringing your attention back to the present moment over and over without judgment. So coming back to the present moment without judgment. And it's been shown that by doing this, it's like a workout for our nervous system. And we learn how to control our nervous system. We learn how to manage our emotions. We learn how to make better decisions. And what emerging adult couldn't use that set of skills, especially in the digital age with all the distractions we have?
In line with this, at one point in the book, you talk about something called perennial maturation, mm-hmm. which seems to involve our development and how, in a sense, sometimes there are gaps in our development from earlier stages of life. And the really intriguing image that's used here is with a set of Russian nesting dolls. And I think most people know exactly what we're talking about. Explain how this image can be helpful in terms of us thinking about how we develop and also the way in which we can, in a sense, perpetually develop and mature.
Yeah. So I use that image of the nesting doll. If you go back and look at some of the work that like Eric Erickson, who was a psychologist and sociologist from the mid 20th century, who looked at adult development in detail, and he proposed that we're always growing and changing. We don't stop when we're physically mature. We know that to be true, for sure. And so I use the nesting doll analogy. So if you have the little tiny nesting doll, and then the next one over it, and the next one over it, if development goes well, everything's going to fit. The dolls are going to fit together. But for most of us, we have bumps in the road. And so there may be a nick or a scratch or an unevenness on the doll so that the doll's, i.e. our developmental stages, aren't fitting well. And in the book, I use I tell the story of a young woman who had some trauma in her teens, and it was affecting her young adulthood. And through mindfulness, contemplation, we can go back and smooth out and rework some of the developmental work that we missed. So it's good news. That's another thing I like about mindfulness. It's very optimistic. We can always go back and heal wounds and mature to the best of our ability.
So in other words, right. So when something happens in our life, or we happen to find ourselves growing up in circumstances in which some of this growth process is neglected or undermined or whatever, it's not as though that is something irreparable, but it is something that we can go back and address. And I think this image also suggests that it is important to do that. That if we don't address those shortcomings in our development from earlier stages, we are unlikely to have a smooth, fruitful maturation from that point on. These earlier deficits, in a sense, will always be there and always affect us.
Yeah, it makes it more difficult for sure. But the neuroscience that of mindfulness shows us that we can go back and heal those wounds.
We're talking with Donna Torney about her book, Mindfulness for Emerging Adults, Finding Balance, Belonging, Focus, and Meaning in the Digital Age. Those four aspects of a happy life are sort of the center points, and we'll return to them in just a moment. What about this digital age in which we all now live, and in particular, the digital age in which emerging adults are growing up? And it is, of course, the only world they have ever known. What is it about the digital age that can create some real issues and challenges when it comes to this kind of development?
Yeah, that's a great question. And first of all, I just want to stress that there are many benefits that we get from technology in the digital age. But what I found in my practice, I was seeing these themes of this group of emerging adults, they're hyper-connected. They're connected 24/7. And yet there's this feeling of loneliness and isolation that can occur. So in the book, I try to address the fact that we are not flesh-colored computers. Even though everything around us seems to be moving so fast, our nervous system, our human system is not developing as fast as our gadgets. So we really, in order to get the most out of our gadgets and out of the digital age, we have to remember that we have this ancient human nervous system that needs to slow down. It needs rest. We're social animals, so we need human connection. And if we can balance that, if we can use technology and still be human and stay social and stay connected, things are apt to go really well in emerging adulthood.
Hmm. You are careful to remind us more than once in the book that we have to be careful about stereotypes, and particularly you direct this to those of us that might think of ourselves as mentors.
Yeah.
And that the mentoring that we do, we need to be careful not to base that mentoring on sweeping generalizations and stereotypes. And I appreciate the fact that you do that, because I think that is probably one of the biggest dangers when it comes to, first of all, talking about this, and when it comes to writing books about this, is to engage in sweeping generalizations, kind of one-size-fits-all solutions, which really don't take into account the complex variety of human beings, and also things like our own learning styles, which is also something that you talk about in your book.
Yeah, and I thank my editor, Peg Johnson, for really pushing me to make this a book for both emerging adults and mentors. And there's a couple of places in the book where I try to walk mentors, whether they're parents or teachers or counselors or other healthcare providers, to remember what it's like to be a young adult, to remember what you didn't know back then, and to remember the things that you yearned for. And by doing that, that puts you in a really good place to be a mentor. You're not going to fall into the stereotypes. You're going to have more compassion. And I think it's also important to point out that we need mutual mentoring right now, because we're in a time, like you said, this group of emerging adults, this is all they know. And they know the digital world, the technology, and they know it much better than we do. So we need their help just as much as they need our help. So I really I talk about mutual mentoring in the book.
And that's kind of an interesting concept that is probably new to a lot of people, but but it makes a great deal of sense, that is for sure. You also want us to maybe rethink, deepen, broaden our notion of what community is. And of course, that's one of the hallmarks of this kind of fulfilled life is a life that is lived in community. How does community look now, and how do we need to think about community in this modern age?
Yeah, well, when I wrote this book, I was really interested in how, wow, this is a time of radical, the industrial age. We can imagine emerging adults in the beginning of the 20th century coming out of rural areas and moving into urban areas. And even some of the changes we saw in the mid-20th century with all the social movements. And we're in another time of great change. And to make it end well, for us to come out of the other side of this, whatever that might look like in the second half of this century, we have to remember that community is what it's all about. So what does it look like for these emerging adults? Well, it is going to be through technology, partly. There's no changing that. It's here to stay. But I do stress, when I meet in the book and when I meet with people individually, it's great that you talk to a friend on Facebook or you're trying to date people through Tinder, but how about the face-to-face contact? Let's not forget that.
So tell us about these center points, balance, belonging, focus, meaning, and how important it is to keep these in mind. I think at the heart of my question is just the fact that, as we look at that, they seem like four relatively obvious concepts that everybody, of course, we want to have these be part of our lives. But I think by taking the time that you do with them, that implies that maybe we tend not to pay sufficient attention to them or think enough about how they can be folded into our lives.
Yeah, that's right. And so what I did with those four categories is I tried to create mindfulness, stress reduction, contemplative exercises, whatever you want to call them. I tried to create categories that would motivate emerging adults. So I tried to appeal to their developmental strivings. So that would be, intimate community or intimate romantic relationships, finding those, as well as independence, so economic, financial independence. And through balance, belonging, focus, and meaning, by paying attention to those four things, emerging adults can gain intimacy and independence. And you're right, they do seem so basic, especially the first category, balance. It's basically about diet, exercise, and sleep, and making sure we balance our use of technology with human connection. And with belonging, I talk about, let's use mindfulness to help you communicate better, because the research shows that it does help you ask for what you want and communicate better and to create closer relationships. With focus, I'm just asking emerging adults, hey, take back your control of your attention span and manage all the myriad distractions that we have now so that you can reach your goals and so that, Facebook doesn't get in your way or other video gaming or what have you, even online dating. I hear from so many young adults the hours and hours they spend on dating websites. And then finally, the meaning category, just ask young adults to look at what they really value. Not what their parents value or what society may value, but their heart's deepest longing. And, we live in an age where we don't have a lot of time to stop and think, to reflect. And it's really critical for healthy development. So I guess that's part of my NEO definition of community in the digital age, is making time for reflection so that we don't make the same mistakes over and over again.
Towards that end, and we should say your book is full of all kinds of very sort of practical points of application to think about these things, to work on these things in our own lives. I especially appreciated a moment in the book when you talk about those moments in our lives when we might feel either estranged from our friends or just kind of distant from our friends, just feeling like we have a life without friends, or we just don't feel close to our friends anymore, or feel like we're being left out or whatever. And as you're helping us kind of talk through this, and I think most people experience at least episodes of this from time to time, but you talk at the, in your exercise there about the difference between inaccurate self-talk and accurate self-talk. And I think a lot of us think that maybe might think that leading a mindful life just means, in a sense, just having this dialogue with yourself and kind of talking through what might be going on. But it's very easy to do that in ways that are simply inaccurate, that just kind of take some kind of misunderstanding we have and deepening it. Which is, of course, probably the most counterproductive thing you can possibly do, versus having this kind of self-talk that is actually true and honest and accurate. Can you talk more about that, the importance of that, and how we can achieve that?
Sure. Yeah, so it is unproductive, and yet it's so human, because we are wired to look at our environment and survey the scene and see where the danger is. That's how we've evolved all these millions of years into the animals that we are, with the big brains and all the things we can plan and do as humans. But the downside of that is, yeah, we are wired to look for what might be going wrong. So both mindfulness and positive psychology and cognitive behavioral therapy ask us to practice, just like we would work out in the gym, practice looking at what is going right, looking at where we're safe, and building upon that. Now, you mentioned, like, yes, young adulthood, it's almost like another, we go through these awkward phases throughout our lives. Obviously, early adolescence is one of those times, but I think we forget that young adulthood is another time of great expansion and kind of awkwardness, where we may feel like unsure of where we're going, unsure of who our friends are. Oftentimes in emerging adulthood, you know, our friends are moving all over the place, or we're moving all over the place. So these exercises that, you know, ask emerging adults to look at what's going right, it helps build confidence, it helps reduce fear, and it helps you reconnect with a new friend group, let's say, if your friends have just moved to another side of the country.
It's really interesting to think about this matter of contemplative practices that you think is really crucial and can really make a difference even in the life of someone who might look at that possibility with really grave skepticism. I mean, that's not ever been part of who they are. Just say a word about why you think, especially given how complicated we all are and how different we are from one another, how this evidently you think is something that really should be part of absolutely everybody's life. I mean, at least I think you're saying that.
Yeah, I am saying that. I think that we need mindfulness as part of our cultural dialogue right now. Because like I said, we just don't have time in our modern lives to reflect. We're a very secular society now. You know, organized religion isn't a big part of life of a lot of emerging adults. Our family circles are more spread out. So there's just no natural point in time where we might be asked to stop and think about our values, about where we're going, about the road we're on. And that can be dangerous. So, yes, I would love to see mindfulness as something that is just, you know, as natural as brushing your teeth. Something that we do every day. It's going to help us become wise. You know, if we can't reflect on our lives, we don't learn from experience, and we don't gain wisdom. So there's this danger of being stuck in a developmental cycle if we don't take time to reflect. And so that can be, you know, true for emerging adults. It's true for people who are, you know, maybe facing midlife, people who are new parents. There are really crucial times in our adult development where, you know, taking time to reflect, contemplate, find community of like-minded people, it's so important for our life happiness.
Say a word about what you describe in the book as mindful media consumption, because, of course, it is this digital age in which we live that can so easily absorb so much of our time and so much of our mental energy and focus. How would you suggest people exercise mindful media consumption? What are some tips?
Well, I would encourage people to look at where they're putting their attention and maybe look at a day. Like, I may have an emerging adult in my office and, you know, I might say, let's look at yesterday. How much time were you spending on technology? How much of your attention was on technology? How much of your attention was on yourself and your thoughts? And how much of your attention was on other people in your community? And just taking note of how you feel and how you think when you're in those three different domains. So we can be on technology and we could be doing something very positive, talking to an old friend, talking to a parent, or we could be doing something that's kind of, you know, not so good for our psyche, trolling Facebook and comparing our weekend with somebody else's, for instance. So just noting, how does this make me feel? I don't think we do that enough. And it can be a great revelation for emerging adults to just notice, well, this is not adding to my life. It's actually detracting from it. And just shifting it as you need to. Maybe you do need to spend more time on technology, talking with your old friends and your parents. Maybe you need more face-to-face time with a new friend in your new community.
A last question. You spend a fair amount of time in your book, not just talking about these emerging adults, but those of us who might think of ourselves as mentors of emerging adults in one way or another. What is a closing word of advice that you would have for us in terms of how we can be more effective mentors for young adults that we care about?
Well, I would say, you know, be on the lookout for emerging adults who are looking for help, because it's interesting. I looked at some of the research that the Pew Foundation did on millennials, and what they found out was that this group of emerging adults really like mentorship, and they really like getting advice from older adults. So as older adults, I'd say, you know, be on the lookout for somebody in your community who's in their emerging adult years who might need your help. excuse me. The other thing I would say is, if you're the parent of an emerging adult, it's okay if you're not the best mentor for them. It could be that you're too close to them and they may need to find somebody who's not their parent who would be a better mentor for them. I'm always shocked at how rational I can be in my private practice with somebody else's 20-something, but when one of my two 20-year-old kids has a problem, I kind of get a little stressed out about it. So I just would want to say that, you know, sometimes as parents, we need to step out of the way and help them find other mentors.
It's a book full of all kinds of practical advice for the emerging adult, for those who are mentors, and gives us a lot to think about in more ways than one. The book, again, is Mindfulness for Emerging Adults, Finding Balance, Belonging, Focus, and Meaning in the Digital Age, published by Whole Person and the author, Donna Torney. Donna Torney, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your very, very interesting book. Best wishes.
Thank you so much.
And the time is 8:40. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For those of you who listen to NPR's Morning Edition today, you maybe heard a special feature about best-selling author Mary Higgins Clark, who has just celebrated her 90th birthday. I thought it would be fun to go into the archives and replay an earlier conversation which I had with this author. Here is that interview from several years ago. What a delight for me to reconnect with one of the most successful authors in all the world, Mary Higgins Clark. Actually, I was just noticing her complete name, Mary Teresa Eleanor Higgins Clark Cohini. What a great name.
God, did you get that?
Yeah, right. But it that would be a little crowded on the cover of a book. So, of course, most of the world knows you as Mary Higgins Clark. And, of course, more than 50 novels to your credit, and every single one of them a bestseller. And your latest book, which has just been published, is called The Melody Lingers On. Of course, quoting a great song from the Great American Songbook. And it is a very, very intriguing novel. Well, you've done it once again, and I'm excited to be able to speak with you about your latest book published by Simon & Schuster. Mary Higgins Clark, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you so much, Greg. It's lovely to be back with you.
You are not letting up on the gas pedal at all, are you? I have a feeling that writing for you is a bit like oxygen is for most other people. I mean, you just can't imagine life without it, I suppose.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, because people say, you know, when are you going to retire and give yourself some free time? I don't want to retire. There's always something going on in my head. And what would I do if I retired? Well, what should I do? Well, I don't have a hobby like planting flowers or baking cookies. God knows I fed 5 kids for all those years growing up, but 3 meals a day. But at this point in my life, if I put a biscuit in the oven, it burns.
Well, you know how to put a book in the oven, that's for sure. You have this just down to a science. Ahead of us talking specifically about your latest book again called The Melody Lingers On, I wanted to ask you about something really intriguing that I read somewhere. I don't remember now where I came across this little tidbit of information from your early life, but I read that as a young adult, you had a part-time job for a while as a switchboard operator in a hotel.
And very young adult. I was 15.
Oh, my gosh. Tell our listeners about that, because the way this story was relayed to me, it essentially conveyed the notion that you probably did a little listening in, as was typical with operators back then. And I wonder to what extent that maybe fueled your imagination for some of these wonderful books you've written since.
Well, a good example is Maggie Ryan. She was the lady of the house and the Sheldon Hotel all those years ago. And I loved her phone calls. Well, she made appointments with men. And one time, because there's a way of, when a conversation is going on, if you're not busy, if you pull the plug out a little, you can eavesdrop without them knowing it. But one time she said to the guy she was making a date with, "Don't say another word. That damn operator is listening in." And I said, "I am not." And I immediately disconnected the call. And a minute later, the chief operator, "Who was listening in on Maggie Ryan?" "Not me, Lord." But what was the story when I sold Where Are the Children? Tennessee Williams lived in the Elysee Hotel, and I was writing radio shows at that time. And we would stop in for a glass of wine, the guys in the office, and then I would always get to my quarter of six carpool. I never missed it because, you know, I had children home. But he would be sitting at the end of the bar. And when I sold the book, but it hadn't been published yet, the bartender said, Mary, why don't I give Tennessee Williams a copy of the manuscript? Maybe he'd give you a plug. And I said, sure. So 2 weeks later, he handed me the book, the manuscript back, and he said, Tennessee said, I have a lot of friends who could write better than that.
Oh, dear. So much for the plug.
So much for the plug. Mm. But apparently a few people liked the book, even if Tennessee didn't.
Right, to say the least. I'm glad you mentioned, although just in passing, the fact that one of your other early jobs was writing for radio. And I want to just, if you don't mind, ask you briefly about that, because you were doing a kind of writing that really, for all intents and purposes, doesn't even exist anymore. But it sounds so fascinating. You were writing very, very short radio programs, from my understanding. Tell us about that project, and also what significance you think it might have had in shaping the best-selling author which you ultimately were to become. Was that any kind of an important stepping stone?
Sure. These were four-minute radio programs, five a week in a station like yours, and they would say, and now today our visit from Hugh Downs, and now today. And it was food, it was travel, it was, the first show I started was called Portrait of a Patriot, and it started like this. At age 14, she was given the family tree and said, but I am nearer to the throne than I realized. Do you know who she is? And this is Hugh Downs for Portrait of a Patriot, furnished by Nestle's, makers of Taster's Choice. You only could give a plug. You couldn't give a long commercial. And then our patriot today was born in England. Halfway through, have you guessed who she is yet? No? Well, here are more clues. And at the very end, our patriot today, Victoria Regina, Queen of England, Empress of India, and all her properties on and on. Tune in tomorrow. So every day I had a different patriot. And I wrote three of those shows at a time, three of those series, a food show with Betsy Palmer, a news show with Bess Morrison, Hugh Downs, Bill Cullen. These were the people who did the shows. And they could narrate 2 weeks at a time in one sitting. And for me, it was $20 a script. So it was $300 a week for three shows. And that was that's what I supported my kids on after I was widowed.
Right. Yeah. Upon the death of your beloved husband, Warren Clark, you really had to become the breadwinner of your family. And I know that it was amidst various frustrations that you actually took up writing in a really concerted fashion, but writing in longer forms. And of course, that's really where you hit your stride, and you've never looked back. I mean, it's been an extraordinarily successful career, and one I imagine you never could have imagined.
I've been blessed with it, because I know so many people who are excellent writers. They get marvelous reviews, and they don't sell books. And that is so frustrating. There was someone who died just the other day, and they said one of the best writers in the country, I forget his name, but he never sold. He was underrated by the public. He might sell 800 books. Well, that's pretty darn disappointing when you've given a couple of years of your life to that project. So I've always been very grateful for the fact that I hit a note in the reading public, and I have not lost it all those years.
Mm, it's true. And it's intriguing that those little four-minute radio scripts that you would write, where you were letting out a little bit of information and a little bit of information, a little bit at a time, in a sense sowed the seed for these wonderful suspense novels, which you have been writing ever since, and which, in a sense, on a much larger canvas, You do the very same thing.
As you know, radio is timed. If you're having an interview, it's just it's this many minutes, not an extra minute. And so I had to time. I used to read my manuscripts in a cadence that the maybe Hugh Downs was doing one or Arthur Kennedy. I knew whether they spoke a little quickly, a little slowly, more emphasis. And that helped me wonderfully with writing because I couldn't write. She wandered slowly through the room. It would be she went. So mm-hmm. I had to do tighter writing, which, of course, is very helpful in suspense.
Hmm. So you end up really thinking about each and every word and about every little snippet of information which is shared, and, of course, that has to happen in a novel as well. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with the great Mary Higgins Clark about her latest novel, which is called The Melody Lingers On. One of the things you've chosen to do here is to make your central character, Lane Harmon, and she's not a cop or a private investigator or anything of the sort. She is an interior designer, or she works for an interior design firm.
She is one herself, and her boss is a famous interior designer, famous and caustic and takes no nonsense from her clients. And she sends Lane up. An investor has disappeared with $5 billion of his client's money. And their lives are shattered because he always went after the little guy. He had his secretary write and congratulate people on their 40th wedding anniversary and say, I would like to help you have a happier retirement when the time comes. And he suckers them all in. And then, of course, the money is going in his pocket, not theirs. And I thought it's an interesting premise. But then Lane goes to the house that they had decorated for his wife. And the feds have taken, they have clawed back everything in the house that was worth taking. So they wanted to elect for the wife of the guy. She's getting a modest townhouse. They select the furniture. But Lane starts to fall in love with the guy's son. A charming, attractive, who emphatically has sworn he is not guilty. He had no idea what his father was doing, nor did his mother. And the point is, did they know something? And as Lane starts to date him, she's getting involved in a serious more than worrisome, because there is someone out there going to kill the wife and mother in revenge for what losing their funds did to his wife. He's deranged, and he said he's spending my money on her. So Lane is in deep trouble, and they are also decorating, she and the chief decorator, the home of this guy's mistress. And was she in on the plot? And where is the money coming to spend $5 million on to decorate an apartment? So I think it's a good mix of characters. I really do.
I really do, too. One of the things I especially like about it is that the principal character, Lane Harmon, finds herself kind of caught up in a world that she does not begin to understand. I mean, it's one thing when you take an experienced FBI agent and you plunk him or her into the middle of this swirling intrigue. But an interior designer, I mean, she doesn't know anything about such going.
No, she only knows that she feels very sorry. The wife said, I don't know whether he's dead. His sailboat had crashed in the Caribbean, and many people thought he had committed suicide because he knew that the feds were going to be after him. They had gotten onto the scheme. So did he commit suicide? Was she in on the plot? Was her son in on the plot? The son even hires an independent agency to say, I want you to investigate. I want you to turn every stone. I want to try to prove my innocence. I know some people won't believe me, but the integrity of your firm, if you are able to come out and say there is absolutely no evidence that Eric is part of this scheme. So Lane doesn't know who to believe, the feds or Eric, and his absolute denial, and no one can trace him to it. And then there was somebody planning to kill the wife and the mother and now Lane. So I think it's a good mix of characters. I love them.
Yeah, I really do, too. Another thing I really appreciate about the novel is that, along with all of the suspense, you really help us feel the authentic pain of many of these characters. Lane herself is a widow, and you write so potently about that. And, of course, as someone who's tasted that sorrow yourself, I guess it's no surprise that you should be able to share that so richly. And then we also get to know some of these characters whose lives have really been ruined by what Parker Bennett has done, including his own wife, Anne. And we get a sense of the dignity with which she's trying to carry on in the face of such disgrace. I appreciate the fact that you really took some time in your novel.
Oh, you want to. If you say this woman is or seems to be bewildered, and she goes into the hairdresser. Well, this happened with Murdoch. His wife went into the hairdresser. She'd always gone, and the guy wouldn't let her stay. He said, too many of my clients have lost their money and are furious. And she had to walk out of her hairdresser. And I use that in this book, but nothing else about the Madoffs. It is not about the Madoffs. It is about the people who have been cheated and whose lives are wrecked. There's even a support group for them in the book. And one couple said, we had to move in with my son and daughter-in-law. And we always got along so well. But now we know they resent us. We're both hard of hearing, and we turn the television on too loud. They go out rather than sit and listen to it.
Hmm.
And we can't do anything about it. I mean, think of yourself in that kind of circumstance.
Hmm. You really help us put ourselves in that position. A last quick question. Tell us about June Crabtree, to whom the book is dedicated.
Oh, dear. June was when we went to Villa Maria Academy together from age 13 to 17, and we had gotten away from each other. Then we both went to Main Chance Spa in Arizona, and the minute she had dark glasses on, a big straw hat, but the minute I heard her voice, I said, I missed your name. She said, June Crabtree. I said, was it ever June Lundgren? And we're sitting in our matching bathing suits and little pink robes. And I said, June, must we always meet in uniform? And one of her very elegant friends said, and where was Villa Maria Academy? I said, on Long Island Sound. And June grabbed me later, and she said, Mary, thank God you didn't say the Bronx. Yes, it was on Long Island Sound, but in the Bronx. And I said, June, if you thought this, the sacred name of the Bronx was going to be thrown around in this joint, forget it.
Hmm.
So we've connected, and we have been close friends all these years, and very close friends. And she died in November that June died. And then another one of our Villa Maria pals just died last month. It's, you know, at my age, I'm 87 and a half. And of course it happens to people this age, but it doesn't make it any easier. So I was so glad to dedicate the book to June.
Hmm. The book, again, is The Melody Lingers On, published by Simon & Schuster. Mary Higgins Clark, congratulations on yet another fine book, and very best wishes to you.
Oh, thank you so much. A joy to be with you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Again, we played that out of the archives in honor of Mary Higgins Clark's 90th birthday. This recording was an interview made 3 years ago. Tomorrow on the morning show, I'll welcome into our studios Dr. Yuri Maltsev, professor of economics at Carthage College, to offer his perspective on the much-discussed tax reform bill that is expected to be signed by President Trump, perhaps sometime this week. What is this bill going to mean for the U.S. economy? What will it mean for the middle class, for richer Americans, for the health of our economy as a whole? That conversation tomorrow. Wednesday, I'll speak with Harlow Giles Unger, a prolific historian and author whose latest book is The First Founding Father. a look at Richard Henry Lee, who was so instrumental in young Americans thinking about becoming independent from Great Britain. Thursday, we'll talk to the author of a book called The Case Against Sugar, some of the ways in which sugar can be a real danger to our health. And Friday, you'll hear my conversation with Ransom Kasha, executive director of the Chicago facility.